Well, Happy New Year, and welcome to CSIS. My name is Ernie Bauer. I'm the chair, Sumitro chair, for Southeast Asian Studies here at CSIS. And I'd like to welcome you for today's conference discussing one of history's most devastating typhoons, Haiyan, or as it was called in the Philippines, Yolanda. Before I frame our discussion, I'd like to thank and welcome our special guests and speakers, especially Philippine Ambassador Joey Quisha, who's here in the front, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for ASEAN, Scott Marcial, and our other experts who we'll introduce in turn. I'd also like to express deep appreciation for one of the most active and caring companies in the space of humanitarian response, and one of the world's top health care companies, Abbott, for its sponsorship of this conference and its incredible role in supporting the people of the Philippines in the wake of Haiyan. And I'd like to welcome Suki McClatchy, who's representing the company here, and Jose Ledonio. Jose, thank you for your support today. For those watching online and on Twitter, you can follow us, obviously, live streaming and live tweeting. And if you're tweeting, you can join our discussion and add your own observation and comments by following at Southeast Asia DC, at CSIS, at Bauer CSIS, which is my Twitter handle, and tracking at the hashtag CSIS Live. Today, we want to look at the impact of this tragic storm and explore the response in the context of U.S. engagement in the Philippines, Southeast Asia, and Asia generally. What happened? What are the lessons learned? How do we build on these events to make us all stronger and better prepared to cope with such tragedies in the future? Now, we know from experience in the tsunamis of 2004 in South and Southeast Asia and in Japan on March 11, 2011, that we're all vulnerable to nature's worst. These storms and the devastation they've wreaked have had profound impact, not only on lives, families, and societies, but on governance, geopolitics, and bilateral relationships. It's in that context that CSIS and the Sumitro Chair for Southeast Asian Studies wanted to look at Haiyan and the U.S. response today. We want to understand the impact of the storm, the status of recovery, and response efforts, and what it means for enhancing our collective ability to plan for future events and build stronger relations between our countries and the region. Haiyan made landfall on November 8th. The deadly storm carried winds of over 200 miles per hour and storm surges over 20 feet. According to wind speed estimates from the U.S. military, it was the strongest storm ever to make landfall. The result was that more than 6,000 people have lost their lives, 10.3 million affected and displaced 4 million across 44 provinces in the Philippines. The storm destroyed or damaged approximately 600,000 homes, 95% of which were in or around Tacloban. The Philippines now accounts, sadly, for 8 of the strongest storms in history. Haiyan is number one. Maggie is in 2010 is number 4, Zeb in 1998 was number 5, and Bofa in 2012 was the number 6 largest storm. The U.S. response, as in 2004 in Aceh and 2011 in Japan, has been comprehensive and multifaceted. It has included both government and private sector support, and the need to respond drew millions of Americans' hearts, eyes, and resources to the effort. The government has provided nearly $90 million, the U.S. government has provided nearly $90 million of support, including $25 million in USAID funds for clean water, sanitation, and temporary shelter that Secretary Kerry announced when he visited Tacloban on December 18th. The Department of Defense has provided over $7 million in the first week, primarily for airlifts and logistical support. And the Marines had 99 people on the ground as soon as Haiyan hit. 900 more arrived from Okinawa within the week. The aircraft carrier USS George Washington arrived 3 days after the storm, along with 80 aircraft to deliver supplies, conduct search and rescue missions. We'll hear much more about the U.S. official response from expert speakers today. The private sector responded as well. As of December last year, U.S. businesses had contributed $45 million in cash, and companies had also partnered with NGOs to provide aid, especially through the American or through the International Red Cross, which has pledged to raise nearly $95 million to support the efforts. We'll hear more about these efforts in our panels today. The efforts are important to understand as they will impact the U.S.-Philippine relationship and the understanding of the U.S. role across the Indo-Pacific. They may also have an impact on the understanding of Filipino and Filipinos and Philippine policymakers in building more trust and understanding of the role of the U.S. military and its presence in the region. The U.S. and the Philippines, as you know, are in the midst of negotiations for terms for increased rotational presence of U.S. forces in the Philippines. Following Secretary of State Kerry's visit in December, we expect that President Obama will visit the Philippines this April during his announced trip to the region. We'd like to spend today exploring the storm, its impact, and the U.S. response in our discussions today. Let me kick off our conference and welcome and start by welcoming Ambassador of the Philippines to the United States, Joey Quisha, and my colleague Murray Hebert to the stage for the Ambassador's presentation. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Ernie. It's my honor to introduce Ambassador Jose Quisha. I think for those of you that work on the Philippines or on Southeast Asia or just hang around Washington, you probably all know who he is. He's a very energetic ambassador who has served here since July 2011. He's made a big push on trade and investment issues and military security issues, and just generally worked at enhancing the profile of the Philippines in Washington. Prior to coming here as ambassador, Ambassador Quisha served as a governor of the Central Bank of the Philippines. He's also been chairman of the Monetary Board and president and CEO of the Philippines Social Security System back in the 80s and 90s. He has over 30 years of experience also in the private sector working in financial services. With that, I'd like to call on Ambassador Quisha.
Thank you. Thank you.
Excellencies, diplomatic corps, distinguished guests, friends, ladies and gentlemen, good morning to all of you. A warm good morning to everyone, despite the very cold weather we are experiencing. I was telling Mary that this is the coldest winter I've ever experienced here in the U.S. I want to also take this opportunity to thank Ernie Bauer, the CSIS Sumitra Chair for Southeast Asia Studies, and Mary Hebert, the Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Sumitra Chair for Southeast Asia Studies for having arranged this forum. And we want to thank the sponsor, Abbott Laboratories, not just for sponsoring this forum, but also for the very generous, substantial support that they have extended to the Filipino people. I also wish to thank our esteemed speakers, led by Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Scott Marcial. We ventured from the warm confines of our embassy across the street this morning for two reasons. First, we want to take advantage of the opportunity to thank the U.S. government and the American people for the tremendous outpouring of assistance we received in the wake of Typhoon Haiyan. At the same time, we also felt that this was a good opportunity to bring you up to speed on developments on the ground and the challenges going forward. I'm thus very thankful to CSIS for this opportunity. As you know, Haiyan or Yolanda, was the most powerful storm that made landfall in recorded history, as mentioned by Ernie earlier. It was a Category 5 storm with winds of almost 200 miles per hour. The strength of the storm created a storm surge with waves ranging from 13 to 20 feet high. Haiyan made it 6 landfalls in Guian, Eastern Samar, Tolosa Leyte, Daan Bantayan, Cebu, Bantayan Island, Cebu, Concepcion, Iloilo, and Buswanga in Palawan. As a result, we lost 6,183 of our people, 2.6 million families affected, and 930,000 families displaced from their homes. Another 26,626 people were injured, and 1,785 people remain missing. More than 80% of the fatalities came from the three Leyte towns of Tacloban, Palo, and Tanawan. The typhoon's impact was concentrated on some of the poorest provinces in the country, and the total damage and loss from the typhoon has been initially estimated at $12.9 billion. Our National Economic Development Authority, the lead agency in planning the recovery and reconstruction, has explained that the sector-level damage and loss assessments are based on United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean's handbook for estimating the socioeconomic and environmental effects of disasters, an internationally recognized post-disaster assessment methodology. While recognizing that assistance is required across a wide area, the government has identified 171 municipalities in 14 provinces and 4 regions that are located within the 100-kilometer storm track as priority areas for assistance, given the severity of the impact of the typhoon in these areas. On the heels of their very active involvement in relief-related activities, the United Nations launched the UN Typhoon Haiyan Strategic Response Plan on 10 December to support the Philippine government's response to the immediate humanitarian needs of Haiyan victims. The plan aims to ensure that communities and local governments recover from the disaster, build back safer, and avoid relapses while strengthening resiliencies. The strategic objectives of the plan are to meet immediate food needs, avoid nutritional deterioration, and build food security. 2, attain protective and sustainable shelter solutions. 3, regain self-sufficiency with the restoration of local economies, agriculture, and fisheries. 4, prevent increases in mortality and morbidity and the outbreak of communicable diseases. 5, regain access to community and local government services, including basic education. The following priority actions have been identified. Shelter assistance, debris removal, restore water system, and access to sanitation facilities, provide food assistance, restarting of local government units, revitalization of livelihoods, reestablish access to public health services, restart education, and strengthen national protection capability. Committed to ensuring that our people are able to get back on their feet at the soonest possible time, the Philippine government's reconstruction assistance for Yolanda, nicknamed Ray, was launched on 19 December 2013 in Manila. Ray is the government's strategic plan to guide the recovery and reconstruction of the economy, lives, and livelihoods in the affected areas. The plan aims to restore the economic and social conditions of the said areas, at the very least, to their pre-typhoon levels and hopefully to a higher level of disaster resilience. The design of Ray and its estimated investment requirements are based on the results of the damage, loss, and needs assessment using data from national government and agency-led sector teams. In some cases, upward adjustments were made to fully reflect the costs of integrating disaster resilience standards into the reconstruction needs for some sectors, as well as to address estimated income losses in agriculture enterprises and to provide adequate social protection. Ray is a roadmap to ensuring that we will rebuild back better to transform the affected areas into more resilient and sustainable communities. The components of the government's plan to build back better include housing and resettlement, agriculture revival and not just resistance, strengthening of social support, not just charity, but true empowerment, elevation of private enterprise, not just to recover, but a stronger orientation towards inclusiveness. In terms of housing and resettlement, we aim for not just survival, but safety. With 60% of the population in affected areas displaced by Typhoon Haiyan, the government is providing emergency and transitional housing assistance to victims, including back houses, which will serve as temporary shelters. The future will see the construction of resilient, permanent homes according to improved housing standards in safer areas. The Department of Public Works and Highways is fast-tracking the construction of 142 bunk houses to accommodate up to 3,336 families in 29 sites in Eastern Visayas. In agriculture, we're looking at revival, not just resistance. Haiyan left in its wake 600,000 hectares of crops ravaged, 387,700 metric tons in lost production, and a significant part of the workforce left without livelihood. A plan is in place to clear and reestablish farmland and agriculture infrastructure and to support the industry through the provision of equipment, animals, and seeds, as well as open channels of credit for farmers. The goal of these efforts, more productive livelihoods. For example, our Department of Agriculture wants to accelerate rehabilitation efforts for fishermen hit by Typhoon Haiyan to get the industry up and running as soon as possible. The Bureau of Fisheries and Aquatic Resources, or BFAR, says 146,748 fishermen in 21 of the country's 72 fishing provinces were affected by the storm. The typhoon flattened crucial infrastructure, including jetties and launching ramps, onshore cold storage and ice-making facilities, boat repair and maintenance workshops, processing factories and markets. Key aquaculture infrastructure was also destroyed, including oyster rafts, crab, shrimp, mussel farms, as well as fish cages, hatcheries, and fish ponds. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, reported the latest DRMC figures put the total damage to the fishing sector at close to $135 million. BFAR has launched a program that aims to provide 10,000 boats to 20,000 families, that's one boat for two families, in typhoon-affected areas over a three-month period. A further detailed menu of farming and fishery inputs needed, depending on the site, includes rice seeds, corn seeds, bancas and fishing paraphernalia, chicken and ducks, fertilizers, draft animals, tractors, farm tools, fuel for farm machineries, and so on. Support is also being programmed for clearing and desilting operations, coconut tree disposal and utilization, coconut replanting, intercropping and fertilization, aquaculture assistance, business development services for agrarian reform beneficiaries organizations, agriculture extension services, irrigation facilities, post-harvest facilities or dryers, and other common service facilities, fish port development, and insurance for agriculture workers. In terms of strengthening social support, we're focused on restoring education, health, and social services, as well as ensuring continued access to local government services. Education and health are basic public services that need to be restored in the soonest time possible. We're glad to report that schools in the affected areas resumed classes at the start of the year. Local governments have also taken a hit, and the national government is providing additional resources in the form of concessional loans and grants to support priority recovery and reconstruction investments. We're also prioritizing the elevation of private enterprise as part of the rehabilitation place, emergency employment of cash for work, and public works programs is being expanded to to provide emergency income support to mitigate the immediate impact of the disaster. This will be augmented by skills training and livelihood development to prepare for self-employment, together with replacement of livelihood assets and training on entrepreneurial programs. Restoring and expanding the operations of private business is also key to inclusive and sustainable employment. Initially, typhoon-damaged business will need to replace and upgrade their assets and will need access to working capital to restore business activity. They will need loan restructuring and refinancing, guarantees, financing through cooperatives and microfinance institutions. From the UN Strategic Recovery Plan and the Philippines RAE program, we find the following common elements: food security, shelter, restoration of local economies, and access to local government services. Now, what is needed to ensure the attainment of these objectives? The government has estimated the recovery and reconstruction needs to be around $8.2 billion. I think here you see a breakdown of those estimates. The estimated total investment requirements for recovery and reconstruction shall cover shelter and resettlement, $4.1 billion, public infrastructure, $645 million, education and health services, $850 million, agriculture, $425 million, industry and services, $1.6 billion, local governments, $90 million, and social protection, $418 million. These amounts will be disbursed over 4 years, in line with a phased, cumulative, and flexible implementation of the Reconstruction Assistance on Yolanda, or RAE, plan. The wide extent to Haiyan's impact, both geographically and in terms of the sectors affected, requires a response that is, one, phased to meet immediate critical needs while planning for sustained recovery and reconstruction. Two, cumulative, so that successive phases of support build on earlier recovery and reconstruction efforts. And three, flexible, to ensure that recovery and reconstruction interventions are able to respond to the changing needs of affected areas. The government has allocated about $800 million for the critical immediate actions which are now underway, and another $2 billion is forthcoming in 2014. This is part of the 2014 budget. The total U.S. assistance package from the U.S. government is estimated around $85 million, which provided food aid, shelter materials, clean water, in hygiene, education, and supplies for families affected by the typhoon, as well as protection for vulnerable populations. This includes the $25 million additional aid announced by Secretary of State John Kerry during his visit to Tacloban in December. The United States government emergency humanitarian aid has provided food assistance, as well as critically needed water containers, heavy-duty plastic sheeting for temporary shelters, and hygiene kits to prevent the spread of disease. The United States also supported programs that help with identification, tracing, and reunification of unaccompanied children, as well as community-level measures to prevent and combat child trafficking. The U.S. military delivered immediate logistical, search and rescue, and transportation support, and delivered additional relief commodities. In total, the military transported more than 2,495 tons of relief supplies and evacuated over 21,000 people from some of the hardest hit areas. All over the United States, Filipino Americans initiated fundraising projects and donation drives to immediately respond to the critical needs of affected populations. The Philippine Consulate Generals across the U.S. reported donations received from various organizations and individuals, and fundraising efforts led by many groups, including non-Filipinos. The diaspora communities, such as the Vietnamese Americans, Taiwanese Americans, Korean Americans, and Thai Americans, turned over generous contributions, and media outfits successfully raised huge sums. Doctors, health practitioners, and other volunteers traveled to the Philippines to offer assistance. As of December 5, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Typhoon Haiyan Corporate Aid Tracker reported over $51.8 million of business pledges to support recovery efforts. We also appreciate the commitment of expertise, capabilities, and other resources made available by our friends in the business community that will hopefully aid in the recovery and reconstruction effort. Greater participation from the business sector will be expected as the Philippine government implements the RAE program. I would also like to add that we have received a lot of individual donations in the embassy as well as the consulates, and we really are very grateful to the American people for their very generous assistance. An example of this private sector response is United States Philippine Society response to Typhoon Haiyan. On November 12, the U.S. Philippine Society, together with CSIS and Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health, co-sponsored a Philippine Health Forum. Unfortunately, Typhoon Haiyan struck earlier, and the U.S. Philippine Society sponsors appealed to the audience and its members for support for the victims of the calamity. The U.S. Philippine Society raised over $1 million and provided the Swilig Family Foundation, its on-the-ground partner organization, $415,000. A part immediately went to relief for 8,000 families in the eastern Samar area where the typhoon made its first landfall. The bulk of the assistance will be given to the pregnant and lactating mothers and vulnerable children. For the first 6 months of 2014, maternal and child care programs will be enhanced to be able to support at least 2,000 mothers. This program intervention is critical since Eastern Samar is one of the poorest provinces with a high maternal mortality rate, 110. And the U.S. Philippine Society and Zwilig Family Foundation collaboration shows how a private sector assistance can immediately be used with proper safeguards and transparency. At this point, it is apparent that recovery and rehabilitation will not be easy, and there are very real and substantive challenges ahead. In this light, we continue to call on our friends in the international community to support this effort. Among others, we welcome your expertise in the following areas: technical grants, standards, particularly housing standards, climate change resiliency, disaster risk reduction. We're also in need of debris management technology experience, technology on shelter, and more health equipment. We will need more funding for the following areas: shelter, health facilities and equipment, educational facilities, infrastructure, and local government unit capacity building. Similar to what the U.S. government did following the earthquake that devastated Haiti, we're also looking at possible trade preference for products from Haiyan affected areas, arrangements that will allow duty-free access for a limited time for a limited number of products produced in Haiyan affected areas is something we're looking at. Now that immediate relief is over, people are now getting used to what is the new normal in the affected areas. But there is much work to be done. And in the spirit of the alliance and partnership we have shared, we continue to count on your invaluable assistance. Thank you and good morning.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Quisha, for that comprehensive overview of what problems the typhoon created and how the government and private sector NGOs and international community have responded. Maybe before I open up the floor, Ambassador, I just ask you, I think you said that the RAE reconstruction program would cost around $8.2 billion. I think you said the government was able to put in around $600 million, if I recall, in
$800 million
in
another
$2 billion. So it's $2.8 billion. Yes. How do you have a sense of where you're going to get the other funding? Have there been donor governments that have contributed, UN,
so far,
et cetera?
So far, we have pledges from governments, roughly about $538 million. And of course, we had representatives of various governments at that session where the RAE program was, but they were not yet ready to make any commitments at that point. So I think the commitments will come in, well, in the days ahead. We also have, for example, from the World Bank, provided an initial $500 million, and they are processing another loan for $500 million. But we are trying to see how we can generate more of the official development assistance, which could be both grants and loans. But ODA loans are very concessional. You have 30 years or 40 years to pay, and at very low interest. Japan has been a major ODA partner, and we understand that Japan is, again, looking at how they can assist the Philippines with additional ODA funding. The UK was one of the first governments. They pledged, I think, $180 million, and they have moved it up to $200. They also promised to match donations from British citizens who are making donations to Typhoon Haiyan. So the response from the international community has also been very encouraging.
So I'll open the floor to questions. If you raise your hand and wait for a mic after I recognize you, and then please identify yourself, your name, your organization. Keep your question or comment relatively short so others have an opportunity to ask questions as well. See a woman back there, please.
Hi, I'm Christine Schenk. I work for the U.S. Navy. I was wondering if you could comment on the role of the PLAN hospital ship that was in the region giving relief efforts.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the role.
The Peace Ark.
The Navy.
The Chinese Navy hospital ship. And what kind of impact have they had on the relief effort and on Chinese-Philippine relations? And if they were coordinating with the Philippine Navy, or who'd coordinate such kind of assistance? Thank you.
Well, from what I understand, the Chinese Mercy ship was sent probably about the third week after the Typhoon Haiyan had occurred. And they were very helpful in attending particularly to the more complex health cases. In the first 2 weeks, we were fortunate that there were two teams from the U.S., the Mammoth Medical Mission from California, that were on the ground on the third day that the typhoon hit, on November 10th. We were able to facilitate their entry. They were on the way to Mexico, but when they found out about the disaster in the Philippines, they changed their plans and immediately left for the Philippines. So they got there on a Sunday, that was the 10th. So they were the first medical mission on the ground in Tacloban. And a few days, a day later, I think a day or 2 days later, Team Rubicon also came in, also from the U.S., and they were very helpful, particularly in terms of the surgeries. Now, unfortunately, of course, they had to leave after about a week, and Team Rubicon left later, but that's also the time when the Chinese ship came in. And so it was very helpful in attending, particularly to more complex surgeries and things like that, because they're a fully equipped hospital ship. And they were on the coast of the Leyte coast. So that was very, I think, timely for that ship to come.
Please, here.
Sir, hi. George Nicholson, a policy advisor to the U.S. SOCOM. A question. You look back at previous disasters like this, the 2004 tsunami in Indonesia, the earthquake that we had in Pakistan in 2006, the criticality of having bases that we can access, getting strategic BRC 17s, other aircraft in, the ongoing discussions about getting back and getting access to previous bases like Clark or Subic or MACTAN. Where do you see that going right now?
In fact, the negotiations have been going on, and we've had four rounds, and I think it's been moving quite well. There are just a few outstanding issues that we're still trying to resolve, but it's clear precisely that the presence of the, for example, the Marines who were there, I think, prior to actually the typhoon hitting the 99 Marines, because they, of course, were aware that there was this huge disaster, typhoon coming. They were there. That really was very, very helpful. And of course, the fact that they were able to bring in the Marines from Okinawa very quickly, they were a big, big help, particularly in the reopening of the Tacloban Airport, because they could not bring in planes, they could not bring in relief goods without opening the airport. And the U.S. military played a very key role in opening up Tacloban. So we recognize the value of having pre-positioned equipment, pre-positioned troops that could assist in disaster relief and humanitarian assistance. So we are currently working on that agreement, what we call a framework agreement for enhanced military cooperation and rotational presence. Another round is being scheduled sometime probably this month or early next month. And we're very hopeful that that agreement could be signed within the next few months.
Let's see.
Good morning, Ambassador Quish. I'm Mitzi Picard of Philippine American Foundation for Charities. Could you comment on the conditions of the refugee camps? I don't know if you want to call them refugee camps, but from what I gather, most of the Tacloban residents have been moved or resettled in Cebu, and some are in Villamor Air Force Base. So I wanted to know the conditions there, and also how are these residents being occupied? I'm sure there's a lot of despondency amongst them. So what is the Philippine government trying to do to uplift and keeping them occupied? Thank you.
One is they're trying, some of them, of course, have left the area, those who could move to Manila, those who could move to Cebu, because they recognize that it's going to take time to really get back to normal. So those who could afford to leave have left, have gone to other cities. Where they can join relatives or friends and so on. But there's still a lot of people in these areas, in the evacuation centers. And this is why government is trying to speed up the construction of these temporary bunk houses. And of course, they are also looking at a longer term plan in terms of coming up with more permanent housing for these people. It's certainly not ideal. There are a lot of challenges. But it's, of course, when you look at situation today versus, say, the first week or second week of the typhoon, it's much, much better. But there are still challenges included because a lot of these evacuation centers are crowded. They have to, of course, ration the supplies to all the people there. And local government just cannot tap or cannot cope with it. This is why the national government has also had to step in. The Department of Social Welfare and Development, the Department of Public Works and Highways, the Department of Interior. So all of these national agencies and departments are very much involved in providing as much assistance as possible. Livelihood is still a big challenge. As I said, in terms, many of the people in Tacloban, for example, are fishermen. So they have to get them the boats, and they're trying to build those boats as quickly as possible to get them back into, you know, into their livelihood. No?
Can I just mention, there's some people sitting in the back. There are two seats over here in the front and two over here, three actually over here. You don't have to stand. Are there any questions on this side, please?
Hi, Krista Zimmerman with Lutheran World Relief. Good morning, Ambassador. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about the Philippine government efforts around transparency and accountability so that people and communities understand where aid flows are coming from and how they're being spent. I know that's something you're working on.
I'm not sure I got the question.
Transparency.
Yeah. Okay, well, what the government did was to put up a portal to report all the donations that are coming to government. And so there is a, what they call Faith, that's the name of that portal, which shows how much has been received and how much has been expended, where the funds have gone to. Unfortunately, it does not report what is given to private organizations. And we're trying to see how we can precisely, you know, come up with a consolidated report, because what we have in that portal are donations to the National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Council, which is the main agency or the lead agency in terms of disaster relief. Then there's the Department of Social Welfare and Development. Those are the two main agencies that have been receiving donations. But a lot of donations are also being given to the Philippine Red Cross, the Catholic Relief Services, or in Manila it's Caritas, International Relief, Direct Relief, et cetera, et cetera. So we cannot keep track of those. And we're asking, of course, the private organizations or the NGOs to come up with their own reports so that we can also try to put together a report that will show donations from. Now, what we also can't track is what has been donated to the American Red Cross, which in turn makes the donations to the Philippine Red Cross. The government is being as transparent as it can with regard to donations to government institutions. But it cannot track the private sector donations.
Yeah, yes.
Good morning, Ambassador. I'm Joy Savilianar from U.S. Philippine Society. It would be very hard to directly link the impact of the typhoon with climate change. I know that weather disturbances have been really intensifying and consequentially the impacts to people and communities. I wonder if there's a reference to the UNSRP or RAE that specifically mentions that certain efforts are being integrated into housing and resettlement, enterprises and agricultural development that's more environmentally sustainable, such as use of renewable energy, so on and so forth.
I believe the national, the NEDA, National Economic Development Authority, is in fact trying to coordinate with the Department of Science and Technology to try to see how they can assist precisely in coming up with a more environmental-friendly resettlement program for these victims. But we don't know. We don't have any details at this point of that. But that's what we understand. With regard to climate change, well, the chairperson of the Climate Change Commission in the Philippines has said that she is convinced that you know these disasters have been the result of climate change. But again, we don't have the scientific proof that climate change has been responsible for these disasters.
Michael?
Mike Masetic, PBS Online News Hour. Following up on the previous question over there, even before this happened, your president was trying to crack down on corruption, but with billions of dollars flowing into a poor area, this would seem to open a potential bonanza for people with sticky fingers. What kind of new efforts or procedures or policies is the government putting into place to make sure that this money goes to the institutions and people that it's supposed to?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things I'd say that the success of the government in terms of fighting corruption can be seen from the tremendous improvements that we have made in terms of the various indices tracking corruption. The World Economic Forum Competitiveness Index, Transparency International Perception Index, the Heritage Foundation Index, and quite a number of these indices show that the Philippines has achieved significant progress. Now, that's not to say that there's no more corrupt. There still is corrupt, and the president, as well as his cabinet members, continue to be very vigilant. Now, one of the more successful cabinet secretaries who has done quite a bit in terms of fighting corruption is the Secretary of Public Works and Transportation. You know, the DPWH was considered one of the most corrupt, if not the most corrupt, department in national government. And clearly that department has done very, because of the leadership of that department. Secretary Singson has done a great job. He initially, for example, in the first year, canceled about 19 projects, public works projects, because these were riddled with corruption from the previous administration. He was under threat, but despite all the threats, he went ahead, canceled all the, and I understand that the savings just from those 19 projects, roughly about 7 billion. He continues to play a very significant role in this high-end program. So to me, what's important is, of course, the leadership of President Aquino, because he has made it very clear to all of his cabinet members that he expects them to ensure that corruption does not creep back. Yes, there are opportunities, as you said, because of all these $1 billion. And this is why the people who have been put in charge there are people like Secretary Soliman, Secretary Singson, Secretary Rojas, who are known to be straight shooters, who have not been accused of corruption or anything like that. So to me, I think it is the people that's very critical to ensure that precisely the proper procedures are done. And the second thing is the transparency. This is why I said they established that portal to ensure that funds that are received by government are fully accounted for. Now, you know, again, I have to be very real and say there probably will be some corruption. I mean, as has happened in some other countries where there were these disasters, and you can't ensure that it's zero corruption. Because even here in the U.S., I think you are aware of the situation where, you know, corruption has actually been in some of the projects and some of the contracts. So the government is doing its best to ensure that the corruption is kept to a minimum.
Thank you. My name is Jenny Illustria from Malaya and Manila Mail. My question is, what is the latest development on the temporary protected status for Filipino nationals? Have you received any response regarding the official request for temporary protected status for Filipino nationals?
Well, we have made the request, and we have not received any information or any feedback, except that they are still discussing this. The Department of Homeland Security is discussing this with the State Department, and they will get back to us when they have something definite. But you know, it takes time, because they have to look into, you know, of course, the justification, and I can understand why it's there. I understand in some cases it took as long as a year for the U.S. government to make that decision.
Andre? Yeah, please.
Sorry. Yes. Thank you. Mr. Ambassador, I'm Andre Sauvageau, and I'm the chief representative in Vietnam for the Interstate Traveler Company. But my question has nothing to do with them. My question is, in the private sector contributors, there is one of the organizations that contributed to the typhoon disaster is an operation called Operation Smile, which is based in Norfolk, Virginia. but it has been active for years in both Vietnam and the Philippines. And my question is, are you aware of their contributions in the Philippines to the disaster? And if so, were they effective?
Well, let me say I am familiar with Operation Smile, because we were, when I was in the private sector of Philippine American Life Insurance, we were supporting that particular organization. And our current commissioner, insurance commissioner, Attorney Emmanuel Doc, was very much involved with that. He was our general counsel, and he was involved with that organization. So I was quite familiar with what they had done, because they've been there over 30 years in the Philippines, and they've done so much good, particularly for the young children who have the cleft palates and all. I don't know what their contribution is to the disaster. I'm not aware what they have done, but I'm sure that they've done a lot of good, as they have been doing over the past 30 years or so.
In the back.
Rand Bailey from Salvation Army World Service Office. It's a follow-up question to the refugee question. There are a lot of people who are still in their locations, in their homes or in their property. And the question of materials to roofing materials and other materials to rebuild has come up. And what's the status of that? Is that something that's being promoted? Is that something that people are saying no? Where are we with that?
Well, yes, there's been a shortage of materials for housing. That has come out in the news, and what the government is trying to do is getting the manufacturers to try to speed up fabrication of materials, GI sheets, for example. I guess the supply is not adequate to meet demand, so what they're trying to do is also trying to import materials from other countries that have this availability, immediate availability of these materials. So that's part of the program under RAE, to provide them with housing materials.
So that's being encouraged, sorry.
Yes.
That NGOs help to support some of that for the emergency response as we wait for the long-term response for housing and shelter. Is that?
See, the problem is that some of the, I guess, residents there are insisting on using some of the, I guess, because they can't afford it, some of the materials that they salvage from their old homes. And that is being discouraged by government, because those materials have been affected, and they would certainly not be durable materials for those people. But again, some of the people are desperate. They want to be able to get back to their homes right away. And the local government is trying to encourage them to wait. But of course, again, they can't wait, so they're using whatever they can get their hands on. But the government wants to provide them with better materials. But again, as I said, unfortunately, the manufacturers cannot produce them fast enough. So they're resorting to importation. But that also takes time, because you have to, you know, import it from countries that are providing those materials.
Take one over here. The woman here in the black glasses, sorry.
Hi, thanks so much. My name is Marcy Hirsch. I'm with Refugees International. Thank you so much for the presentation. I wanted to ask a question about the reports of increased child trafficking and also increased vulnerability expressed by women, women and girls who are living in evacuation facilities, who are just expressing an increased fear of sexual violence in the wake of the disaster.
I didn't see it.
She's from Refugee International.
Yes.
To put child trafficking in.
Again.
Child trafficking. Reports of that, and also sexual abuse against women.
Well, the thing that we of course have to be vigilant about are precisely not just drug traffickers, but also child traffickers, women traffickers, etc., and the government is very much aware of the risks that are, especially when something like this happens, So the Drug Enforcement Agency has been alerted. The local police have been alerted. And then, of course, there are also agencies that there is a task force that has been set up by the national government that looks at all sorts of trafficking cases, sex trafficking, labor trafficking, drug trafficking, and so on. It will certainly be a challenge for government because some of these people are desperate. They need cash and so on. So the thing is, again, it's the coordination of local government and national government agencies that would be critical to ensure that these cases of drug trafficking, labor trafficking, sex trafficking, etc., are kept to a minimum.
Please join me in thanking Ambassador Quisha. We're going to end this session and move to the next one.
Ambassador, thank you very much.
So if you need a bathroom break or coffee, please feel free to go. We're going to segue pretty directly into the next session, which has three speakers from the U.S. government talking about the U.S. government response. Thank you.